Another busy show Thursday, August 12th, 2021, right here on Connecticut Today. Abortion was the subject in the 3:30 segment. Dr. Ann Hendershot joined us from Franciscan University. She signed on to an amicus brief on a key abortion case going to be heard this fall by the U.S. Supreme Court. 4:30 segment, State Rep. Craig Fishbein, Republican representing parts of Wallingford and Cheshire, talked about some Republican proposals to tighten up the juvenile justice system. And I also had some thoughts early in the show regarding possible changes to how Connecticut police could or could not stop vehicles for minor motor vehicle infractions. Here's a question for you. Do you think that police in Connecticut should alter the way laws are enforced, or should laws be adjusted to compensate for race? To compensate for the ethnic makeup of someone, to compensate for what are considered norms in certain neighborhoods, in certain cultures? Or should the law be colorblind? Now, I'm not talking about how the law is implemented, but should the law be for everybody? White, black, Latino, Latinx, Latina, Chicano, Asian American, Pacific Islander, Buddhist, whatever. Klingon, Ferengi, whatever. Romulan. Should the law be the law? Now, the answer to that is kind of obvious, I would think. It doesn't take an Einstein to say, yeah, the law is the law. Now, you could talk about how much to concentrate on it, what it would be. But apparently now we're having, again, as a result of tragically, I guess, what happened to George Floyd last May, we have this these recommendations made to lawmakers. And what I try to do here on the show, folks, is I try to give you the big stories and I try to read some more, and while I'm reading, read some more. And to find out, I dig deeper. I spend a couple of $100 a month on all these subscriptions I have to make sure that I know everything that's going on, or the stuff that you should know about, diving deeper beyond the headlines. And this is interesting. And I set up our Facebook question of the day at WICC600, facebook.com/WICC600, to talk about this, because I saw this article and a million things started to flood my mind here. Do you agree with a new push to prohibit Connecticut police from stopping drivers for broken headlights and other minor violations? Are you okay with that or not? Now, I'll read it again. Do you agree with a new push to prohibit Connecticut police from stopping drivers for broken headlights and other minor violations? Knowing, by the way, that sometimes these stops by police lead to the apprehension of other criminals or clues as to what may have happened somewhere else. Now, you're probably saying to yourself at this point, Paul, what in the hell are you talking about? Stopping, enforcing minor violations? This has to do with race. What are we talking about? Well, guess what? Stay here. We've got news, traffic and weather together. We'll come back because that's exactly what could happen. Could. It's not in law yet. It would have to go to the General Assembly. But there are some people saying, hey, you know, certain things are accepted in certain neighborhoods, kind of on race. So why don't we just ease up on this stuff? Now, who's saying that? When would it take effect? What are we talking about? I'll tell you straight ahead. First, 2:26, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. So the question I asked, and this is our Facebook question of the day, and you may wonder, why am I asking this? Well, I'll explain. Do you agree with a new push to prohibit Connecticut police from stopping drivers for broken headlights and other minor violations? Now, let me say something right up front. I'm a suburban, white, pudgy, white guy, and I've been stopped twice in my hometown in the past 10 years, probably 8 to 10 years. I know it was twice. I remember once exactly where it was. I've been stopped twice because I have a headlight blown out. So, yeah. I know people are going to say, well, it's to ease off on minorities getting stopped. I've been stopped twice. I'm a white guy. I got stopped twice by a white officer. Sir, do you know your front left headlight is blown out? Yes, officer, I do. I'm going to get it taken care of. I said one time, and I think I said the other time, I have an appointment coming up. I'm going in for an oil change, and my mechanic's going to change the headlight. Fine. All right. But, he didn't just say, go ahead right away. He took my license. He ran my license. He looked around the car. He had his service flashlight. He was looking in the front seat, looking in the back seat. So, yes, as a white, pudgy, suburban white guy, I've been stopped twice for a blown out headlight. So let's get to the meat and potatoes of this. Why am I bringing this up? Well, according to the Hartford Courant, and this story actually was posted yesterday, couldn't get to it because of the Yankee game yesterday. Headline is, police could not stop Connecticut drivers for broken headlights and other minor violations under new recommendations to lawmakers. New recommendations to lawmakers. Now, hang with me here. It's a little complicated. I'll tell you what's going on here. And again, this is a story in the Hartford Courant by Dave Collins. Proper credit where credit is due. Police officers in Connecticut would be prohibited from stopping drivers for a broken headlight, displaying their license plates in the back windows, and other minor violations. That's under recommendations approved earlier this week, Tuesday, by the State Police Transparency and Accountability Task Force. So again, a lot of this was put in place by this police accountability bill that was jammed through after the George Floyd death. The suggestions that will be submitted to state lawmakers, now these are suggestions. These aren't laws yet. These are suggestions. The suggestions, says here in the Courant, that will be submitted to state lawmakers come as data show Black and Hispanic motorists in Connecticut are stopped at disproportionate rates for vehicle equipment and registration violations compared to white drivers. Some of the task force members said they hope restricting police from stopping drivers for what they call secondary violations curbs the disproportionate stops of minorities and decreases confrontations where police use force on motorists. Now, we're going to unwrap that in just a few minutes after traffic and weather together. I want to unwrap that because there's about 15 things in that that jump right out at me. If I'm reading this right, we are now going to adjust certain laws and the enforcement of those laws because too many minorities get pinched. And by the way, one of these laws that they're talking about, your friendly host here, the white, pudgy Italian guy who lives in a majority white suburb, I've been pinched twice for over the past 8 or 10 years. I remember approximately what the time frame was, but I've gotten nailed twice. Okay, so in my own town, I'm a white guy by a white police officer. So, but the bottom line is here, there's been a set of recommendations that was approved earlier this week by the Connecticut Police Transparency and Accountability Task Force. Basically, what they're doing here is they're trying to lower the classification of certain minor motor vehicle violations because too many Black and Hispanic motorists get pinched for them. Now, here's the question. Now, let's look at this logically now. Here's the question. Is that a purposeful racial profiling by police? Is that done on purpose by police, or are the majority of these violators minorities, black or Hispanic? You see what I'm saying here? In other words, I'm reading this, and this doesn't surprise me, but are we adjusting the laws because too many people of one ethnic group break the law, or is there quantifiable evidence that if you're white and you drive around with a broken headlight or a taillight, or if you have excessive window tinting, are you not, in fact, stopped because you're white? The suggestions that will be submitted to state lawmakers come as numbers show black and Hispanic motorists in Connecticut are stopped at disproportionate rates for vehicle equipment and registration violations compared with white drivers. So again, my question is there an active bias going on? Or in fact, are Latino, black, minority drivers, do they just break the law more? You see what I'm saying here? And it's not, and I don't care if who does it, white, black, Hispanic. If you break the law, you break the law. I got pulled over twice. I thought I was speeding both times. And I said, well, geez, I'm not going that fast. He's pulling me over for this. And sure enough, both times I had my license checked. I got a warning. A retired New Haven police officer who's on the task force, Shafiq Abdus-Sabur, said, quote, "It's those type of stops that seem to be the stops that go bad, that go off into something greater that creates a bigger issue that results in a lawsuit or an officer being fired or terminated." Okay. Well, here's my question. Why does the stop go bad? Is it the fault of the driver resisting when an officer said, "Hey, I pulled you over. You know you got a headlight out, right? Or you know your windows, the tint here is illegal." See, okay, yes, some of these stops do go bad. I understand that. But why do they go bad? Is the cop at fault? Yeah, sometimes I would assume so, yes. Is the driver at fault? Is this usually, you know, is this one of those cases, or do these cases abound where the driver says, please, cop says, please step out of the car, and the driver, for whatever reason, starts to panic because of what may be in the car? So let's go here. The panel is recommending that secondary violations include having a single headlight, okay, a single taillight, or a brake light that's not working. Having a license plate in a back window, which is common in cities, would also be a secondary violation if all the letters and numbers are clearly visible. But because these violations would go to a second level, if I'm reading them right, it says right here, police could not stop drivers for this. The proposals also include extending from 30 to 60 days the period for which failing to renew a registration is considered a secondary violation. Several other minor violations would also be considered secondary infractions. Why are we doing this? Can somebody please explain to me why are we doing this? Well, we want to reduce police interaction. Why? It's not always the cop's fault when things go bad in these interactions. I know there's a segment of society that likes to say, well, it was obviously the cop's fault. Sometimes it is, but sometimes it isn't. Now, a local police chief is not happy with this. We'll tell you who that is momentarily. And he gives an example of how a road stop for a minor violation turned into an investigation into a major crime. See, to me, if you're a criminal, I don't care where you are and what city you are, black, white, or whatever, if you're a criminal, all right, and you're dumb enough, right, if you're stupid enough to be driving around with illegal tint or with a blown out headlight or taillight, you deserve to be pulled over. You deserve to be tossed in jail. You do. Honestly, you do. Get the traffic and weather together momentarily. Dave and Meriden. Dave, what's up?
Hey, good afternoon, Paul.
Hey.
You know, these minorities complaining about this type of traffic stop, well, you know, boo-hoo. Get your act together. Keep the car in the shape it's supposed to be kept in.
And you won't get stopped.
Don't have tinted windows. Right. Don't have tinted windows that are so dark that I can't tell if you're in there naked or with a AR-15 pointing at me. You know? I mean, come on now. And then this board, the advisory board.
Yeah.
How many of these people are minorities on the advisory board?
I don't know. I know a couple are. You know, Dave, it is what it is. It's mind-numbing that we're saying, well, we have to modify the laws because too many things go bad when there's a vehicle stopped. Well, why are the vehicles being stopped?
Yeah. I mean, I've got stopped for a couple of minor things here and there. My stop never went bad.
No, mine didn't either. Dave. Yeah. Dave,
did what I was supposed to do.
Appreciate the call, Dave. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I did what I was supposed to do. I remember he came up to me, tapped on the window. Good evening, sir. Hey, what's up, officer? Was I speeding? No, but you do have a front and a light out. Can I see your license and registration, please, and your insurance card? Okay. He said, well, here comes the ticket. I think I got a ticket once, and the other time he said, when are you getting this fixed? I said, I have an appointment with my mechanic this week. He said, all right, please get it done. It's not safe. Now, would that stop have gone as smoothly if I was black or Hispanic? Maybe. I don't know. I'm not that cop. Would he have asked me to have stepped out of the car if I was black or Hispanic? Well, maybe. Of course, if I was and any cop asked me to step out of the car, guess what? I step out of the car. And I say, oh, geez, if I have something in there, I'm screwed. Here we go. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. This all ties in with our question of the day. Do you agree with a new push to prohibit Connecticut police from stopping drivers for broken headlights and minor violations? There's a police accountability board. It's going to push lawmakers to basically say, can we ease off on this? Because too many minority drivers are getting pinched for this. Really? Do they not know where to buy headlight bulbs? Do they not know that a certain level of window tint is technically illegal? What are you tinting your windows, by the way? I've always wondered this. What are you hiding in the car? When you have limo tint on your windows, what are you hiding? What's going on in the car? Maybe who you're pointing a gun at? Okay, so there is one local police chief here, according to the Hartford Courant, who, although I believe he voted in favor of these recommendations, he has some reservations. Says here, although the task force okayed the recommendations unanimously, Milford Police Chief Keith Mello, a member of the panel, said he was concerned over reducing the number of traffic stops because they occasionally lead to the solving of other crimes. And again, that's what these proposals would do. In other words, cops would not be allowed to pull over somebody with a burned out headlight or a taillight. And the reason given is, well, usually behind the wheel of members say it is a minority driver that is driving that vehicle. All right. Well, here's my question. I mean this in all sincerity. Why do minority drivers, black, Hispanic, Latino, whatever, why do they drive around with a burned out headlight or an improperly displayed tag? Or window tint that's too deep and violates state law? You see what I'm saying? In other words, there's an admission here that there's stuff that is allows cops to pull people over. So instead of telling people, don't do that, we simply say, instead of putting the onus on the person, why are we easing the law? Can somebody explain that to me? I think you know what the answer is. So this may be a somewhat rhetorical question, but I don't get this. Well, I do. I do in a blue state. I get it. Now, if some of these stops result in a stop that goes bad and it's the cop's fault, fire the cop. Don't ease off on the law. Well, Paul, maybe we should ease off on the law. Well, Milford Police Chief Keith Mello said that when he was a patrol officer years ago, he tried to stop a car, says here in the Hartford Courant, because its headlights were not on. I passed two or three of those every night on the turnpike or on the parkway on the way home. The driver fled and somebody threw a gun out of the car. When the car finally stopped after several crashes during the chase, Mello said police discovered the occupants had kidnapped and repeatedly raped a woman and were driving around with no headlights on. Gee, Gunga Din, why do you think they had no headlights on? I don't know. Mello said, quote, anytime you reduce contact between the police and the public, there will be an impact in terms of crimes that are solved, crimes that are prevented. What that impact is hard to measure. So again, seems to me, just because there's a racial aspect here, we're saying, let's let some of these people go. There might be a few bad police stops. And like I say, if the stop is bad and it's the cop's fault, fire the cop, fire him, fire her. The person who was stopped should file a lawsuit. But is the real fear here that there's going to be too many things that police find when they pull over some of these drivers and more of them end up in jail or are wanted on warrants? I'm just wondering, you know, and again, this is coming from somebody who's been stopped twice on headlight violations. Want to shift gears back to a subject that everybody has an opinion about. Yes, it is abortion. And joining us right now is a professor of sociology at Franciscan University in Steubenville. Now, Dr. Ann Hendershot was one of 240 female scholars and professionals who signed on to an amicus brief in an abortion case that you're probably going to start hearing a lot of in the upcoming months called Dobbs v. Jackson. What's it about? Does it have anything to do with Roe v. Wade? Could this end abortion on demand? Would abortion then become a state's rights issue, much the way gun laws are different from state to state? Dr. Ann Hendershot joins us. Dr. Hendershot, Paul here at WICC. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me here. Yes, on October 4th, that's the big day, Dobbs will be at the Supreme Court. And it is a big deal. It won't end abortion on demand in all states, but it could make a big difference in some states.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, let's explain the case, Dr. Hendershot. Dobbs v. Jackson. What is it, and why did you sign on to this amicus brief? Lay out the case for us.
Well, I'm a pro-life Catholic, and I believe that it's wrong, and abortion is wrong. But I signed on to this case because I believe that abortion harms women. And what this case does is it prevents abortion after 15 weeks of gestational age. So only in the case of medical emergency or instances of severe fetal abnormality will a woman be able to get an abortion in Mississippi. This is a Mississippi case, and Dobbs is the person who brought it, working for the government, on behalf of the government in Mississippi. And those who are contesting this is Jackson's Women's Health, an abortion provider. So what this does is it's really all about gestational age. So it's a very interesting case for those of us who have been pro-life for many decades, because I think this has the potential to really do away with that concept of potential life. You know, very often you hear the pro-choice side say it's not really an unborn child, it's just potential life.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Mississippi case erases that concept of potential life. We know it's a real human being that is being created in the womb, and so there's nothing potential about it. And so this 15-week cutoff, and that's what it really is, Dobbs would be a 15-week cutoff unless it's a medical emergency or severe abnormality. And we believe that I signed on with 240 professors, lawyers, physicians, scholars to support Dobbs in this and support the pro-life side. This is a big case, really big case.
And 15.
So it's exciting.
Yeah, and Dr. Hendershot, hang on. I want to come back. We have to take a break here. I want to talk about perhaps why that 15-week period was chosen and how it might compare to other countries, which might surprise people, other countries who do have abortion rights, but maybe not to the extent that people think. Dr. Ann Hendershot is the guest. She's a professor of sociology at Franciscan University. Get back to the good doctor straight ahead. First, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. A few more minutes with Dr. Ann Hendershot. She's a professor of sociology at Franciscan University in Steubenville. She has signed on. She's a signatory to an amicus brief. Supreme Court case coming up, oral arguments, I believe she said, on October 4th. Dobbs v. Jackson. Jackson representing, of course, the an abortion provider. Dobbs, the state of Mississippi, on possible limits to abortion. And Dr. Hendershot, you said this would set a 15-week limit, and you also point out in some of the info I have here that although some people may say, oh my God, 15 weeks is too low of a limit, how does that compare to many other countries, Dr. Hendershot, that we are often compared with?
Well, it's still much more liberal than every other country that most of us would want to be compared with. France and Italy, Germany, Spain, Norway, Switzerland, they put the gestational limit as 14 weeks. And 15 weeks is more generous. It's actually more liberal. And that's why people kind of say, oh, no, but I signed on to this because we know that an unborn child at 15 weeks can feel pain, actually even younger. But an unborn child, we know that the human nervous system forms by 6 weeks. And by 15 weeks, a baby in utero does not just detect pain, but is capable of suffering. Now, you know, today we do surgery on the fetus before birth, and even pro-choice anesthesiologists have recommended the use of medications to relieve pain in that fetus if they're doing fetal surgery. So we say a child at 15 weeks, an unborn child, feels severe, inhumane pain against a child. And so I signed on because of that reason. The 240 women scholars also signed on because they want to dispel the notion that we need to have abortion in order to have women play a full role in the job market. We believe that's false because we don't support abortion and we all have fulfilling careers and wonderful lives. And we've done that very well. I mean, our new Supreme Court justice is a pro-life person, and she did not have to support abortion to become a Supreme Court justice.
You also,
so we're trying to say that.
Yeah, you also, yeah. Dr. Hendershot, say here that there is quantifiable evidence about a link between women who have abortion and clinical depression. What is that?
Yeah, most people don't realize that. There are several studies we know that women deserve better than abortion is our slogan in the Feminists for Life. Abortion in young women, there's a study in the Journal of Child Psychology found the risk of suicide 3 times greater for women who aborted than for women who carried their pregnancy to term. And that's controlling for poverty and everything, age, race, mm-hmm. marital status, divorce. Controlling for all of that, they still have a suicide rate of 3 times greater than women who carried pregnancies. Another one is clinical depression. Women whose first pregnancies resulted in a birth were much more likely to... women whose first pregnancies resulted in a birth, even after controlling, did better. Women with abortion were 65% more likely to score in the high-risk range for clinical depression. abortion is bad for everyone. It's certainly worse for the unborn child,
but
it's very bad for women.
But there are undoubtedly women listening to us right now, Dr. Hendershot, who would say, hey, stop the proselytizing. I understand where you're coming from. They're probably saying, okay, that's your right, but don't tell me what to do with my body up to a certain point. What would you say to them?
Well, it is your body, certainly your body. But there's a child inside your body that is not you and has the right to life. And so we need to remind people that this is a human being. It's not potential life, as Nancy Pelosi often says. This is a child that from conception is a human being that is separate from you.
If the state of Mississippi were to prevail here in the high court with the arguments this fall and maybe a decision mid next year, what do you think, Dr. Hendershot, would be the results of this case, the ripple effect, if the case is decided in the state of Mississippi's favor?
Well, it certainly will chip away Roe and Casey, because they would discard viability. They would breach the viability barrier. The decision would probably not come until next June.
Yeah.
And you're going to see a lot more amicus briefs on both sides. We got ours out fairly early, but there's already quite a few. But it's not going to overturn abortion, and people need to know that. New York's not going to be affected by this, and maybe not even Connecticut, where you are. But Mississippi will be. And it's just going to be harder to get an abortion, and that's a good thing from my perspective. But it's certainly not going to overturn all abortion laws. Those states have already, they've already precluded that ability to overturn their, they have these other clauses.
We'll see how it shakes out. Dr. Ann Hendershot, professor of sociology at Franciscan University in Steubenville. She is one of the signatories to an amicus brief. We'll keep an eye on the case. Likely argued this fall. A decision may be coming in June. Usually the big cases are decided right when the term ends. It's Dobbs v. Jackson on abortion. Dr. Hendershot, thank you so much for the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thanks. Bye-bye. Dr. Ann Hendershot there. So we'll see. Dobbs v. Jackson. Jackson representing the state of Mississippi. Dobbs representing the state of Mississippi. Jackson regarding someone who is looking for an abortion at a later gestation. This would set a limit perhaps of 15 weeks in Mississippi. Now, not nationally, but again, you would have another fragmentation here of abortion rights. All right. Earlier this week, the Republican caucus at the State House, State Senate, State House, all that, releasing a list of desired reforms, criminal justice, juvenile justice here in the state. Of course, a lot of controversy now over juvenile car thefts, carjackings. Democrats saying, hey, this is not a big deal. The numbers are coming down. Republicans are just fear-mongering. We've been told by people like Bob Duff and Martin Looney. Republicans and even some Democrats are saying, but hey, the number of repeat offenders out there with long lists of arrests is not good. Craig Fishbein joins us, State Rep Wallingford Cheshire, the ranking member on Judiciary. Mr. Fishbein, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Good afternoon, Paul. I think you've just discovered a new way that we could identify DUI at the roadside. We would have the driver say festering fungus three times fast.
It's like a new field sobriety test, counselor.
Is that what you got?
But would that be admissible in court? Can you tell me that?
Of course, we can put anything in a statute these days.
Speaking of statutes, Craig, I see you folks came out earlier this week, and I went over briefly here on the show some things that I know the Republicans and, Craig, even some Democrats who were showing up at these community gatherings are saying, okay, maybe there are some tweaks here. I don't know how many of these you get done, even would be considered by the majority Democrats, but talk a little about what you would like to see done and why these are being put forward.
Sure. Well, why is, you know, there's a loud, large public outcry. You know, over the last few years, there's certainly been an escalation in juvenile crimes across our state. You know, I'm going to be sharing a video in the next few days of appears to be some young men going to somebody's driveway, stealing their car. You know, enough is enough. So we did, on July 7, call for a special session to look at these issues. On that day, we did start to engage in talks. And we said we're going to look to different collateral groups, you know, see what they have to say, see what suggestions they have. And, you know, we had meetings with DCF and the state's attorney's office, the public defenders, the various police groups, you know, those that are really boots on the ground with regard to this system. And we bounced some ideas off of them. And, you know, some of the things that we came back with are, you know, and we learned a lot, too. But some of the things we came back with, you know, right now, fingerprinting of a juvenile is discretionary, which is troubling. You know, we hear from the Democrats, well, the juvenile justice system is unfair. It's, you know, slanted against certain individuals. Well, here, when you have discretion on something as basic as fingerprinting, it just opens up the system to that. So we would have, you know, by statute, if a juvenile is arrested for a felony, a Class A misdemeanor, or a charge that results in loss of life or serious physical injury, a sexual assault, one involving a use of firearm, that it not be discretionary. There has to be fingerprints, you know. Another thing, you know, we hear from the Democrats, well, law enforcement has the tools presently to detain, but they're not using them. But the problem is, we learned through these discussions, is all the officer has available to them at the time of the application is that particular arrest. They don't have the record, which just baffles me. You know, so you would want the law enforcement officer who makes that determination, I want to ask a judge for permission to detain, to have the full record. You know, maybe this child was arrested a few days before for stealing another car. That would give rise to, okay, you know, something else is going to happen. That just leads to repeat incidents. So we would have that access to law enforcement of the record, which they don't presently have.
So you're basically talking about, Craig, having almost real-time access to what? A database, right? Is that what we're looking at? Hey, this kid got pinched a week ago for the same thing, right?
Yeah, and that technology is out there. We do have juvenile probation officers that are in the system, and we would have one who's assigned 24/7. Or, you know, so that law enforcement can reach out to them. Similarly, we handle it with judges. You know, if a law enforcement officer is going to apply for an arrest warrant in each judicial district around the state, there is a judge who is on call 24/7 so that the officer knows who to call to go to. We would do the same thing with a juvenile probation officer. This is the one you can get the record from. It only makes sense.
Okay. So there would be a gatekeeper there. In other words, that would assuage, Craig, the idea that, well, you're opening up this kid's file to everyone and anyone. That's not the case, right?
No, it's certainly not the case at all. And anybody who says that doesn't know anything about the system. You know, another thing is when those detention orders are sought and a judge denies them, we want to know why. So within 24 hours, the judge would be required to articulate in writing why they denied it. You know, because maybe the system needs some changes once you get to that point, but nothing has been identified at this point. And we do have repeat incidents happening, which, you know, part of this is to curtail that.
Yeah. Craig, hang on. I got to take a quick break here. Craig Fishbein is the guest. He is the ranking member, the ranking Republican member on the Judiciary Committee, laying out some of the tweaks, slight changes that don't sound crazy to me, the untrained mind, about getting a better grip on some of these repeat juvenile offenders, particularly that are out there and we're reading about more in the news. First, traffic and weather together, then Wall Street, back with more on WICC. All right, coming up to 4:52, another check of traffic and weather together. Less than 5 minutes away, a couple more minutes with Craig Fischbein, ranking member, State Rep Cheshire Wallingford, Republican ranking member on the Judiciary Committee, talking about some suggestions Republicans and I would imagine some Democrats might favor regarding juvenile justice here in the state. Craig, you know, we've seen the rhetoric from the majority party about how this is fear-mongering, this has racist overtones or undertones, you know, wherever that was. And there was that news conference on Friday, and the drone that we hear as well, car thefts are down, car thefts are down, car thefts are down. Okay, that's good news. But as I said here, Craig, I think what disturbs people is they see that these juveniles that are arrested have multiple arrests, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 arrests. And you guys and gals in the caucus also have a lot of police officials agreeing with you.
Yeah, you know, we have to examine the statements from the Democrats. So first of all, when they say car thefts are down, where are those numbers? The state police have been asked to disclose the numbers for 2021. They haven't. So what are the Democrats pointing to? They're pointing to numbers from 2019. Those are the latest numbers that are out. Also, when they talk about, they don't talk about car thefts. They talk about arrests. There are many, many car thefts in this state that there are no arrests for. So you have to be very careful because, you know, I'm seeing that those statements from the Democrats, they just talk about arrests being down, but not the actual incidents. And they have no numbers to rely upon. I just know that my constituents are calling me on an almost daily basis. You have to do something. And, you know, the things that I went through with you before are all common sense. You know, another one is we would have expedited arraignments. You know, arraign the juvenile the next day if they've been arrested for a felony or certain significant crimes. Right now it's 2 weeks, up to 2 weeks, that these arraignments are happening. A lot of bad stuff can happen in the meantime. So, you know, we're not looking to move heaven and earth here, but we're looking to get some common sense things done.
Now, the governor said, Craig, last week, I guess he was out of state, taking a little break, which was fine. The governor said, hey, we need to do something, chop, chop, quick, quick, paraphrasing regarding some of the information that you alluded to in the first half of this discussion. So are you at all, are you convinced, are you hopeful that the governor will do by whatever executive authority he has, will he loosen up some of this so some of this information on the short term can get to prosecutors or judges or police?
He doesn't have the executive authority to do that. I know when he left the state, you know, it's ironic that the legislature gave him emergency power and that the governor and the lieutenant governor leave the state and leave the power in the hands of Martin Looney. I don't know if anybody's got the irony over that one, but to make these changes would require statutory changes. And I know the governor made representations that he had changed things, but I've checked with rank and file law enforcement. That's just not true. Nothing has changed. So he said it when he left the state. It didn't happen. I would hope that the legislature does something, but right now there's been absolute silence from them.
So next step is what? He comes back from his break. He comes back and what? You keep the pressure on or is anything going to happen? Now, what am I hearing about a special session next month? I heard TCI may come up again. There may be other stuff. Any shot this gets debated in that or not?
Well, the special session has to be called for specific purposes. Mm-hmm. So if a special session to deal with juvenile justice is not permitted by the Democrats, then we would not be able to have that special session. But that's what the people are looking for. is answers to this. They're not looking for TCI. They're looking to keep their property safe and sound from being ransacked, stolen, and things like that.
Craig Fishbein, ranking Republican, General Assembly Judiciary Committee, state rep, portions of Cheshire and Wallingford. Craig, good to talk with you, and we'll talk down the road. Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. There you go. Well, all right. So he laid out what a lot of people want. And there are Democrats, by the way, folks, on board with this in a lot of suburbs. You're not, like Craig said, it's not a heaven and earth thing here. Just, you know, allow the flow of information between an arresting officer, the police station, the prosecutor, a judge. Allow that to me to be more free form here. Now, if you take any of the things Craig mentioned and you mention them to the majority Democrats, they say, well, it's fear mongering. There's no real problem here. Martin Looney, who is the acting governor, he is on record as saying that any talk about this is racist as well. They want to go back to the 80s and 90s, racist policing, whatever. It's the Constitution state, folks, the state of confusion, the People's Republic of Connecticut.